So I thought I would just introduce what we're doing and then introduce our speaker tonight. So the format for this fall is going to be slightly different in that we're responding to what people said back in the spring, that they wanted a little more time for longer meditations. So we've worked into this schedule one time a month where we have two periods of meditation rather than meditation in a class. So that's what we're going to be doing next week. So we're going to have a block of meditation. And then once a month, Joseph will be coming. And Joseph is a great friend of ours and a wonderful Buddhist practitioner. He's a therapist and an astrologer, and he wrote this book called Between Fortune and Providence, which gives you a clue where he lives and how long it takes him to get here, an hour and a half. So we're really grateful to have you, and I think it's going to be really helpful too.
And the book is a commentary on Dante.
Yes, that's it. The book is a commentary on Dante, Astrology and the Universe and Dante's Divine Comedy.
So if anyone here has to recover from their former Catholicism, that's a good read.
Okay. Well, and Joseph is a counselor, a therapist, addictions counselor, and knows a lot about, has studied Italian, goes to Italy. He's got a lot of interests. He's a runner, so I think we have a broad brush here in terms of his background, and we're delighted to have you. So the module we're doing now is module 19, and we'll be using this book called Lojong, Cultivating Compassion Through Training the Mind by Trolog Rinpoche, and the information for that's online. So that's the main book, but I brought others. I won't hold them up. But there are many other books you're welcome to use on Lojong. And Lojong is mind training. Joseph will be giving an introduction to what we're going to be studying. But you're welcome to use other books. You don't have to just stick with this one. And the other thing that's a little different about this module is I've designed it, and we've worked together, mostly Erica and Elise and I, to have the old teachers do more on the absolute bodhicitta slogans. And then we really like to have everyone participate in this module as teachers and present material from the relative bodhicitta slogans. And we'll give you more information about that. But there'll be a lot of opportunity to bring forth your own understanding as you work with this material. And I think it could be really a lot of fun. So that will be coming along later. And the main thing with Lojong is it's very practical. And as you'll see as we go along, there's a lot of ways of applying it in our daily life. So that's the main point. And
which previous module?
Yes, thank you, Michael. Module 6 in February of 2015 is when we first taught Lojong in the Waltham Buddhist Meditation.
Boy, is that organized.
It's a long time ago. Module 6.
You remember.
And, well, I didn't remember. I looked it up. And thank heavens it's all online. The book we used was Pema Chodron, Start Where You Are, A Guide to Compassionate Living. So if you find the book we chose a little too heavy, this is a little maybe more accessible. Maybe. So really, it's up to you. You can use anything you want to work with these slogans. And you can listen to the material. There's the Chogyam Trungpa book, right? Training the Mind.
I have a few others up there.
And I have others you can look at if you want. And I think we posted those, or we will, online. So so I think that's really it. And there'll be plenty of time to work with this material. I think we're going to go through December with this module. So incorporating more meditation, incorporating more chance for people to present and have a lot of discussion.
So. Yeah, make a dent into the material.
Exactly.
A little dent.
A dent. Okay.
You know, like on the hood of your car.
Okay. Oh, that's a bad one. So there you go, Joseph.
Okay.
Carry on.
My big question is, how long do I have?
We end at 9, so...
Okay, then.
Yeah, and we end with the dedication of merit.
Okay.
And you don't have to talk the whole time.
No.
That's for
we
damn
have
sure.
A lot of discussion.
We have a lot of people
you
who like to talk.
Yeah.
And it's, you have to record it.
It is recording, yeah. I think so.
So I talked with Erica briefly over the weekend about last week, so I think we can continue somewhat in the same vein and then extend further into Lojong. And I also heard from Erica that people love handouts. So I made a handout for you. The problem is I didn't make enough because I thought there'd be fewer people here.
I can make
she
more
can make
right
more.
Now.
She can make more.
That's my sitting.
So hand it to Elise.
Okay.
Tell Elise. Her what you need.
Probably 5 or 6 more.
Okay.
Thank
you. That's the blooming lotus.
Okay, the blooming lotus.
So the topic last week was compassion. And our universal desire to have for ourselves more of it. And why don't we have enough? And why can we be so selfish? And why don't we think of others? And that's one point of view. Sometimes that can be sort of a theistic point of view. We can do Catholic guilt on our lack of compassion. The other angle is that why do we not think we have enough unless we already have some? That if it wasn't us to begin with, we wouldn't either care or we'd be doing something completely artificial to who we are. And so then the question is, if we have it already, why don't we manifest compassion like all the time? And we all know the answer to that. We get in its way because of habitual patterns, because of fear, because of insecurity, all kinds of things. Interestingly, it's an increase of confidence that often leads to an increase of manifesting compassion. And so it's something we have that's not always available to us. So how do we make it available? And different spiritual traditions do different things. Some use prayer to a deity who can help bestow that compassion. We do something else as Buddhists of the Tibetan tradition. We make lists. and we put words together in funny ways. And that's how we begin. And so what happens is we find that the word compassion is kind of vague. So Buddhists like to be precise. So the Sanskrit word that tends to be used for this kind of enlightened compassion is bodhicitta, and the Tibetan is chanjuv ki sem. Important word is sem. And there's all kinds of traditions about what this is, how we can do better. And here's time for the handout. Take one down and pass it around.
What did you say? He said, take one down, pass around. I said, isn't that how many beers are on the show?
We can sing. I don't know.
I do remember summer camp as a kid. Now, this isn't going to make sense to you unless I talk about it a little bit. Well, I guess now there are more than we need. So, bodhicitta, in English, sometimes you like to use the Sanskrit or the Tibetan simply because there's so many different translations in English. Is it awakened mind, awakened heart, mind of enlightenment, Herbert Gunter calls it enlightened attitude. They're usually two words. One has to do with awake or enlightened. The fact is, the words are not the same. Also, the other word has to do with mind and heart. And you sort of need both to actualize this kind of compassion. It gets more interesting because there's absolute and there's relative. And you can call both compassion, or you can call both bodhicitta. And here I have, this is from, Gampopa, who was one of the lineage holders for the tradition of these slogans. And this is absolute from his book, Dual Ornament of Liberation. The mind of ultimate enlightenment is beyond the world, free from all elaborations, the supremely pure subject of the ultimate, stainless, unmoving, and very clear, like the continuity of a lamp sheltered from the wind. That's absolute. Any response? Any reaction to that? Does that sound like compassion? It's not very feelingful, is it? It's not very personal. Quite the opposite.
Can you say it again?
It's a lot of words. I'm sorry?
Can you say the... Oh, it's right there.
The mind of ultimate enlightenment is beyond the world. This is worth memorizing, by the way. Free from all elaborations, the supremely pure subject of the ultimate, stainless, unmoving, and very clear, like the continuity of a lamp sheltered from the wind. It's not personal.
It's not very emotional. It seems not to be emotional, just mind.
It's just mind.
That's because we keep connecting compassion with emotion.
But it's what does absolute mean? It means it's not subjective.
Right.
It is not a feeling, an attitude that we have, because all our feelings and attitudes are temporary.
Right.
We feel very soft and warm, and then 20 minutes later we're anything but. So, however, this is an important consideration because it works hand in hand with relative, which is mostly what people talk about when they talk about compassion. And relative is down here. Liberate all sentient beings from suffering through compassion. And it liberates sentient beings from suffering, from all kinds of different suffering. Whether it's being sick or being poor or being insecure or being confused or being unenlightened. And so the relative bodhicitta, the relative mind of enlightenment, is that which wants everyone to be happy and feels everyone's suffering directly. They say, you know, you have to work on this until you can't bear the suffering of other people. So this is emotional, and it's vivid, and it's sharp. In some ways, it's tough-minded, but it goes hand-in-hand with absolute bodhicitta. Why? Because relative is relative. Relative comes and goes. We'd like it to stay, but it departs. So we have to find a way to bring the absolute and the relative together, to take our innate, inherent, soft spot, our feeling for others, our empathy. The word compassion in German is Mitleid, to suffer with. And so we have to do that by blending that somehow with the sense of absolute. There are different traditions to do that, that have been around for many, many, many years. And One of the traditions is from the Tibetan lineage pioneered by a guy named Atisha. So sometimes we talk about Atisha's slogans. Well, they're not quite Atisha's slogans, but they're based on his teaching. And Atisha was the guy who was a very nuts and bolts kind of character. He was not that interested in ideology, in logic, in confusing the heretics. He was much more interested in helping people actualize relative and absolute bodhicitta, because that was the essence of enlightenment, and enlightenment is the essence of being a Buddhist. And so he's a guy, he's famous for, he heard that he traveled to Tibet and he taught people in Tibet at the time of the second translation period, around the 1000s. And he took along a servant because he was known as very surly, because he had heard that Tibetans were such really sweet, wonderful people. And later he said that he didn't need to take his tea served. He had plenty of opportunity to practice patience. And he taught people how to actualize bodhicitta. And he had a student. And his student had a student named Chikawa, who came up with the 52 slogans. And they've been part of the Tibetan tradition since. This is where I can do show and tell.
I thought there were 59.
Maybe 59. Well, 52 is a deck of cards, isn't it?
Depends which kind of deck of cards. If it's your low jumps.
If you're low jumps, right. Yeah, right.
And if you're not playing with a full deck.
That's true. That is.
So, in the 1800s, Jamin Cantrell came up with his commentary on the slogans, very pithy, very bare bones, very direct, and it's based upon this that we have...
I have a pile of books.
Me too. Right. If you want anything. Here's an American student. Alan Wallace, Buddhism with an attitude.
With an attitude. Buddhism with an attitude. Oh, that was good.
Here's Srila Rinpoche.
Yep.
And here is Khyentse Rinpoche, Enlightened Courage. So those of you of a Nyingma persuasion might be interested in this in particular. It's beautiful. Wonderfully written. And they're all commentaries on these 59 or 52 or however many slogans there are. They also work in tandem with another Mahayana tradition that came from India to Tibet, and that is embodied in Shantideva's Way of the Bodhisattva. Now, the Lojong does not put together an architecture. It gives you things to think about, and you put together the architecture. And Shantideva, who lived about 200 years before Atisha, who never left India, as far as I know, wrote the book, the contemplative book on how to be a bodhisattva. Mm-hmm. However, it's very fire and brimstone, it's very tough-minded, it's very poetic, and it can be very complicated. And so, although Tibetan teachers generally have been schooled on Shantideva, and I love listening to teachers do Mahayana talks and the little places where they quote Shantideva without telling people they're doing so, because it's so much part of their upbringing. But when the Tibetan teachers came over to America and to the West in general, they found that Atisha's slogans fit the bill much better in terms of helping people actualize progress toward relative and absolute bodhicitta. So how does that happen? I have a quote here from a Kagyu supplication, it says, and there should have been a line break, but there isn't. May whatever temporary conditions arise be conditions for realizing things as they are. Grant your blessings so that the natural state may dawn from within. My focus is on temporary conditions, because I don't know about you, but sometimes I look upon a day and I think of all the things I could have learned and all the things I could have done and all of the opportunities there were to sort of get conscious that I just passed me by. Because I was so intrigued with this, that, or the other thing that I don't even remember what they were anymore. But still, they took up the entire day. And so, the teacher of Mahayana, using these slogans, becomes your world, your situations in life. Someone asked Trungpa Rinpoche who his guru was. I think it's in Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism. Trungpa Rinpoche said, "Well, my gurus, I left my gurus." He said, "Oh, situations are my gurus." And then occurred to me later that that's very much what the teacher's slogans are doing here. So this is an empowerment to wake up any moment and use any situation in life to pursue the path. So, let me shut up for... Not bad. Let me shut up for a short time and see what people have to say about any of this. Or none of this. People have had background with this material, some of you.
Some, but not everyone.
Not everybody.
So, maybe even just...
I'd like to hear from someone who remembers back, 3 years ago?
Or who's working with the slogans, or who feels somewhat familiar with them, maybe. That would be helpful.
Or who's excited by the possibility.
Excited by.
please.
So, the thing I wanted to share was when I first started doing Tonglen, which was actually before we did this, was that I teach school and I had something really tragic and challenging happen. And I spoke to Emily and said, I really actually can't sit and meditate at this point because this thing happened and all I do is think about it. Mm-hmm. She said, "Oh, well, that's when you do Tonglen, because there's a lot of suffering that you need to sort of deal with." And I think that was, for me, really helpful, that it was a way to not say, like, "Well, I'm going to sit here and try to keep my calm..."
Right.
Focus on my out-breath, because that was not, like, going to happen. I think that's a really powerful piece of it. Mm-hmm. It gives you a way to practice with something that for you is directly suffering and not saying, "Oh, I'll just forget about that for the next 30 minutes."
And we all know how, when we start sitting at like 7 in the evening, and I don't know about you, but I've been through some adventures today, and it's hard for the mind. It's hard. There's a temptation to just want to push the world out of your mind. And why can't I be calm? And that's usually beside the point. I mean, obviously it's a fine thing. We need to learn how to rest. Sometimes in the middle of all kinds of things. But we can also use our experience as a means to forward ourselves, forward our awakeness, we could call it. Anyone else? Because what I want to do now is sort of give an overview of them. Please.
Actually, at the same time that I'm reading this, I'm reading The Enlightened Vagabond.
Which is what?
It's Patru Rinpoche.
Oh.
It's just a whole selection of stories about him, which I feel like has gotten me through my week. I love the stories about them. It's just short vignettes about him. Great for just if you need a quick little pick-me-up to kind of captivate your mind and think about it on your commute to work. And I remember one of the things that just stuck with me last night when I was reading after a really tough day at work was he said, the wild mind, I'm not quite sure if these are the exact words, but the wild mind and the calm mind are the same mind. The same thing. Mm-hmm. We keep trying to embrace one and avoid the other.
Right.
They are the same. Right. He said, see if I can get it right. He said, it's our, essentially what I got out of it was, it's our relation, our desire to have one or the other. Mm-hmm. That's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the state of the mind. It's our desire to have a state of mind. So it was really good because I had a really wild mind. And so that kind of like let me let go of trying to make my mind other than what it was at that time.
There's this, I think a lot of people have this experience. There's a set of exercises in the Kagyu tradition working with moving mind and still mind.
Mm.
It's universal. And when people try to work with still mind, their minds won't shut up. And when people want to work with moving mind, nothing's happening.
Yeah.
It's like mind always is, it's like a contrarian teenager.
Yes.
It always does what you don't want it to do. So the question is, how can we take that contrarian teenager, not just get it to behave a little bit better, but use its energy and its resourcefulness and its curiosity. And that's what this stuff is for. So, you go down the folds, if you fold your thing in half. There are 7 points of mind training. And one distinction I want to make is the word we use for mind. Okay, what's the word we use for mind? Remember I said that bodhicitta is chanchukki sen. Okay. Sen is one word for mind. Sen is the mind that is intentional, that thinks about things, that has a direction. When I agreed to teach tonight, that was sen. It's like, and we said, will you teach on September 21st? I said, oh, sure. But that was sen. Lo, is in lojong, is, oh, the mind that got you dinner somehow before you got here after work. There's me at my GPS trying to get here, and it's starting to get dark out, and I'm getting a little worried because it seems to be different from where I was before. Lo is the mind that we carry around with ourselves. It figures things out on the spot. So that's the mind we're going to tame. It's not this, not some kind of retraining. This is not some kind of magical, mystical kind of thing, but the stuff that you use, I don't know, to get undressed and to get into bed tonight. Not very special, but that's what we're going to train. Because that's where things are happening. It's not the big poetic fantasies that we have. It's the ordinary stuff. So that's what we're going to work with. So, there are 7, not 59, but 7 points of mind training. Divided unevenly. And here they are. And some of you will recognize some of the slogans. We'll talk about how to use them. But first, the preliminaries, I guess Elise will talk about in 2 weeks.
In 2 weeks.
Yeah. 2 weeks.
So people have time to read that part and get ready and, as you said, work with it a bit.
Are the preliminaries the same as the 4 reminders?
Yes.
Okay.
And what is the purpose of the 4 reminders?
You're going to give away, like,
my It's very simple. I'm going to say almost nothing of content, but what is the purpose?
Remind us, maybe?
To get our attention.
Just get with the program.
Get with the
Give us another list.
Give us another list.
A shorter one, though.
Oh, no. If you read the Nyingma stuff, Precious Human Birth has like 15 different categories, and that's just the first section. So, the preliminaries is basically to set our attitude.
Set our attitude
of not copping to our bullshit. Okay? I didn't hope I didn't steal your thunder from...
No, that's
fine. Okay. You can quote him on that, though.
You can quote me on
your
that.
Bullshit. It's a good What's title.
The, yeah, but I didn't see where he explained the Tibetan and the Sanskrit word for bullshit.
I would like to know that word. What's the Tibetan word for bullshit?
There's probably 20.
You know more Tibetan than I do.
Well, I think the word for bullshit in Sanskrit is samsara.
There you go.
Touché. And in Tibetan is nyangele. Yeah, it's all painful suffering. Just
yeah.
Continuous.
Sounds painful just to say.
So, number two is the actual practice. And this is stuff that you can actually do on the cushion or you can actualize in your daily life. The actual practice is called the cultivation of bodhicitta. Therefore, it has two parts. Part one, absolute. Part two, relative. Absolute, I'll talk about next time I'm here. Regard all dharmas as dreams. It's how to work with the tinsel quality of our experience and of our minds. And how to recognize that there's nothing to hang on to, which is scary, and it's also liberating, because we don't have to hang on to anything. And that's the good news, same as the bad news. So those are five absolute slogans. Relative bodhicitta we talked about a few minutes ago with Tonglen. And it's a description of Tonglen. It's a description of exchanging oneself for others, sending out your joy, your goodness, your intelligence, your happiness, taking in the kind of schmuck that people send our way.
Schmutz.
I'm sorry. Schmutz. She's my Yiddish corrector.
Good. Watch your tush.
I went to Brandeis, but it was a very long time ago. My Yiddish has gotten a little rusty. So that's the actual practice. And so everything else is taking the show on the road. Number three, everyone's favorite point of the seven, transforming adversity into the path of awakening. Why is this everyone's favorite? Because everyone has adversity. Everyone has situations that they don't want to be in, or people dealing with that they don't want to deal with. And so it allows you to rub intelligence against the visual pattern. And so this is the transforming adversity. This is the drive all blames into one. Or be grateful to everyone. Gulp. Now we'll talk about how to apply this at the end.
Wait, could you just repeat that phrase you just said?
What?
It allows you to rub
Please.
I think I'm being way too structural, but so are the 59 slogans all
contained within these seven points?
They're all
thank you.
They're under here. Okay.
Thank you.
I don't know if they were all under number two.
Oh no,
yeah,
no.
Practice. Okay.
No. They're unevenly distributed among the seven.
Okay.
There's a big way at the end, the last two.
The don'ts.
The don'ts.
Okay.
So transforming adversity into the path of awakening is very popular. Maintaining the practice for the duration of our lives, less popular. But however, as I am far closer to the day of my death than when I first learned this material, There are instructions on how to live in Mahayana and how to die in Mahayana. I hate your funny bone. Okay. And it's very good, especially if you work in hospice, to be mindful of these five powers, of these five strengths. Then, number five, we're back to popularity. Measuring your success. How do you know you're doing well, or whether you're screwing up? Or whether your effort really needs a little bit of uplift. And actually, I'll just give you the four slogans here. All dharmas agree at one point. That one point is diminishing ego. Anything you do that you call dharma that doesn't do the job is not dharma. It's very helpful. Of the two judges, rely on the principal one, meaning everybody thinks that you have your act together, and you know better. You're the principal judge, I'm sorry to say. Always have a joyful mind. That may rub against some habitual patterns in your work life or with your spouse. And then you're well-trained if you can practice even when distracted. Because we're all distracted, but sometimes we can sit with that and sometimes it's much harder.
Yeah.
So that's how we measure our success. It's very useful to have some kind of a way to say, you know, I'm doing okay, I can always do better.
Could you explain the second one again, please?
Of the two judges? Okay. As you may know, if you start, let's say you're really working hard on this material, and you're trying to be gentle, and you're trying to be more intelligent, and people around you, like your family, starting to notice, and they appreciate you more, and they're beginning to give you compliments, and it's very easy for that to kind of sink in. What doesn't sink in is how our mind feels when we start sitting at night. Because then we realize just how confused we can be and how far we have to go toward anything called intelligent or compassionate activity. So that's the principal judge. We are. That's it. It's very direct.
You know yourself best.
Much better than anyone who's conned by your seemingly good behavior.
Just ask your friends. They'll tell you the truth. Just ask your friends.
Yeah, your Vajra friends will not be.
They'll cut you down.
Actually,
your spouse.
Okay, commitments of mind training. How we practice in the minutiae of life, and Lisa called them the don'ts. A lot of them, they all have the word don't, it seems. Don't proclaim about injured limbs or find fault in people. Don't turn gods into demons. In other words, don't take good dharma and make it selfish. But there are some not don'ts, like...
Not don'ts.
They're sort of do's, like... Was it train your mind, but with the first one? Relax as it is.
Yeah.
Which means basically persevere and make an effort, but don't be a pain in the ass to other people or to yourselves. Relax with that. So it's very helpful, and these things will come along in the details of life. And there are about 20 of them. So you have all kinds of possibilities here.
We can add our own.
We can add our own.
If you finish the toilet paper, replace it.
That's a good one.
All right. Well,
but he should have had a lot of reasons he didn't have that.
Yeah. Or if your spouse doesn't replace the toilet paper, find a better way to bring it up than you usually do. That's more in line with what Atisha would say.
Yeah, right. Then you have to think of a different slogan to apply, right?
That's do it differently. Point. In some ways, all of Atisha's slogans can be boiled down to do this differently. Uh-huh. I'm sorry?
Don't wait in ambush. Don't. Like, yes. You roll in one sheet and then see what happens.
Right. Actually, that is a perfect example of when to use the slogan.
Yes.
Because you're using low. You're on the can.
There you are.
Okay.
Let's use the slogan. Put Uncle Chum's version.
The toilet reading.
Oh, we can make a list for the, you know, to put up in the bathroom.
Right.
That can be very creative.
A really good class project.
That can be great.
The 23 ways to distract yourself with a cell phone.
While you're on the toilet.
So, and number 7 is guidelines of mind training. And these are the ones that, they're sort of the caboose, and people don't pay enough attention to them. And one of the things I wanted to do is sort of my pledge is to really work with number 7. Because there are a few of them, there's a couple lists, it's a little complicated, it's like, they're not very poetic or as interesting, but, you know, like two things, one at the beginning, one at the end, which is the beginning of the day, you aspire to do it better. At the end, you say, well, have I? And you act accordingly, you proceed accordingly. Or a personal favorite of mine, whichever of the two occurs, resolve it into patience.
That's great.
What are the two? Happy times, sad times. Mm-hmm.
Difficulties and fun stuff.
Right. The Patriots win the Super Bowl and all your friends and you are really happy. Resolve that into patience. You just got a letter from the IRS. Open the letter, but resolve whatever the contents are into patience. And because what we tend to do, we tend to ride along with the highs and the lows, and we just circle round and round. And so it's a reminder. So, and the last one. It is variously translated as don't expect applause, don't expect gratitude, or don't expect thanks. But I think you get them all.
Yeah. Yeah. Or don't expect more.
Don't expect more.
We translated it as don't expect applesauce.
Don't expect applesauce. What if you don't like applesauce?
I don't know. You need humor with these slogans, really.
If you don't like it, still you shouldn't expect it. Right?
So the question then is, so I've given you a flavor of what they're like. But what happens, really? Mm-hmm. There's a process. When I and Emily, you were probably in my class. Back in like 1981 or something
could
like
have
that
been, yeah.
On the slogans, and we were told to memorize the slogans, and we had to take a quiz, and we had to, like, I think we had to even write them down or something.
Maybe.
I remember we had to memorize them, and that was very useful. The problem now is there are all these different versions with all these different translations. So that's a handicap. But it pays to... The ones that occur to you most strongly are certainly worth memorizing. The ones from Trungpa and from Pema, I think, are the most vivid and the most graphic. So, for instance, it'll say in slogan 6, they'll say, like, don't be competitive. And this says, don't sharpen your competitiveness. There's a difference there.
Mm-hmm.
you know, you get this image of a person sort of, you know, working at a knife. And so don't sharpen your competitiveness. It's easier to remember. So there's that.
And also, often the slogans are in the back of whatever volume you have. Mm-hmm. So if you look in the appendix, you usually find a list. So Pema uses Trungpa Rinpoche's translation.
So I think when we did it last time, you actually had a like two-sided thing with all of them.
Yeah, that's online.
That's online.
So look in Module 6, and you can print it out.
I have it in the back of Pema's book. So
right, it's in the back.
Look quickly.
And of course, you know, as you know, the book we're using here, Chalig Rinpoche's books, the translation is slightly different from what we did before. So again, you know, I think it's in a way challenging to have a different translation, but also really helpful because you get a little angle.
His commentary is sometimes widely different.
Yes. Widely.
That's the next step. You read the slogans, you read the commentary, and you might compare some.
Yes.
Especially if there's some of these that are that sort of grab you or feel particularly relevant. Read up on them from different sources.
Well, or something leaves you completely clueless about what actually it means. Mm-hmm. That's another way to understand the use of multiple translations or commentaries, because you know, you're looking at Tibetan language, which is like one of these languages is very intuitive, and it's made up of these little monosyllabic terms that get compounded, and they have a lot of different meanings, and it's not. So whoever's translating it is bringing their understanding of that.
So what happens is there's a lineage of commentary.
I was just reflecting on the comparison you had. Don't be competitive. Don't sharpen your competitive edge.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Competitiveness.
But I heard, like, I mean, you were talking about the edge. But I like the contrast between the two, because especially Trungpa Rinpoche's, because it almost speaks to you're going to feel competitive. It's a feeling that's going to come up.
That's right.
And what his to me speaks of don't further it. Don't run with it.
Exactly.
Let it just be there and just be there. Mm-hmm. Whereas the other one is don't be competitive. It almost makes me feel like I should feel scolded because I'm feeling competitive.
Okay. That brings me into what's our attitude toward them?
Right.
We've learned about them. We've memorized some of them. Maybe we have little cards or even posters. I had a poster when I was first doing this with all the slogans. Of course, it was.
We could bring that in. Maybe I think I may have a card.
Do you? All right. Yeah, I know what happened to mine.
Yeah, it was a big calligraphed skull. Yeah, it's possible.
I'm sorry. What?
Might be able to make copies of that.
Well, it's actually in the. It's actually not calligraphic, but it's in that.
It's in here.
Then the question is, what happens in daily life? You've read all about, only have a joyful mind, and you understand that that's because not you have to pump up yourself into being happy, but you feel very solid about who you are and what your aspiration is. And one of your fellow Sangha people pisses you off, and you get you start to like grouse. Okay, now what happens is there are different approaches. You can be theistic about it. You can say, "Bad me. Oh no, I have a resentment. I'm not having a joyful mind at all. Actually, my state of mind sucks. Maybe I should go just have a beer and forget about it." There's no point in that. I mean, we're not in the business of using these things to pummel ourselves, or certainly to pummel our Sangha friends. So one thing you don't do, you know how in 12-step programs, they say, don't take other people's inventory, take your own. Same thing here. Don't tell your friend to drive all blames into themselves. Bad form. Very bad form. Instead, these are ways to wake up and to experience your mind. That's the point. It's not to say, oh, I'm bad, I'm not doing it right. It's like they serve, if we sort of worked with this, and they sort of come naturally, they serve to kind of just jolt us a little. Mm-hmm. And that's a good thing. It feels uncomfortable. Because, you know, we know what it's like when we have momentum toward the same damn thing we've been doing all our lives, and how powerful that momentum is. And we find ourselves in the same fight with our coworker, our spouse, or the same resentment with our boss, or the same puffery we do with other people, and then we all of a sudden we kind of know better, but we're still doing it anyway. And I don't know about you, but I find that's very uncomfortable. And you know, it's a good discomfort because it shows growth. It shows that you're actually able to, you're not getting out of your habitual pattern, but you're beginning to transform it. And this is where it starts. And you can look further and notice, what is the mind of ultimate enlightenment? Free from elaborations, the ultimate, supremely pure, subject to the ultimate, stainless, unmoving. That's the mind, by the way, that stops us in our tracks when we are about to do something, then we realize that that's not what we want to be doing. And you know, there's another slogan called "Give up all hope of fruition."
Yeah, it's my favorite.
Now that doesn't mean to stop trying. we are very inventive when it comes to being lazy. So instead, we realize that there's no graduation party. The Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are not going to celebrate our achievement. And we plug along and we do our best, and we're grateful for what we can do well, and you know, the next day we try to do better. Not a problem. And in the meantime, while we're doing that, all of a sudden people around us are getting a little more sane. our partner is actually becoming reasonable. Our boss likes us. Our employees feel comfortable with us around. Not because we're trying to do anything except wake up in the moment. Let the situations become our guru. And then, enlightened activity is a natural byproduct. If it becomes effortless, then you're not treading on the path. The path is sort of moving under you.
Moving sidewalk.
What's that?
Like moving sidewalk.
Like a moving sidewalk in an airport.
Yeah.
Of course, being me, I love to like walk along the moving sidewalks and go real fast. I think most people do that. So, okay. Enough of my sermonizing for the moment. Any questions, thoughts, retractions, disagreements? Everybody's raring to go get your slogan. Oh, by the way, I never like the word slogans.
Yeah, it's not a great word, but what word...
It reminds me of the Red Guard in China in the 1960s. Right. With.
But
know,
we don't really have another word, though, for this. Because they are reminder. Did you use the word reminder?
Or well, yeah, I just drew the motto.
Motto. A motto. Not quite.
Do you use those cards?
Okay, so this is really great. Did you pick them up on retreat at all? So there are various ways of working with this, and there are things called slogan cards. So you may have seen them, or you can buy them, and we can help you find them online. But you can make your own, which is really neat. You can buy just index cards, maybe the big ones, and you write the slogan. And what I found helpful, then I try to remember what it means and write what I think it is on the back. And then I'll look it up and write whatever I find.
In coaching, we use the word cue. It's supposed to jog. It's a short term that means so much more.
Right.
And you study it and you do it, and because a cue is a term that helps you enact an action for a sport. Inaction is complicated, but the cue triggers an automatic response to get you to have the desired outcome.
How about a heavy hint?
Yeah, no, that's good. But I think the main point here is we're not going to go through these like one after another in a list the way we did last time. And, you know, often you go through the 7 points in order. We're going to do the absolute bodhicitta slogans first because they lay the ground for the relative, so we don't sort of get stuck in good and bad and whatever, too much judgment. So we have the absolute we're going to cover first. But when we get into the relative, I think all of our basic aspiration is for us to actually have these slogans come alive in our life. Mm-hmm. And it's not that you memorize everything under number 2 or 3 or something, but that you dig up the ones that mean something to you and read them and study them and look at them and then start to remember when situations come up, you apply the slogans.
Well, I was going to say it could be the other way around, too, that when you find yourself in a kind of uncomfortable, googly situation, there's usually a slogan there that you can relate with, that you can find and will pop. Once you've got some familiarity with them, as you were saying, they'll pop into your head, and you'll go,
I taught a course on this in Providence about 10 years ago, and at the final, what we did is I made up about 12 situations in life, and I wanted to see what slogans come up for what people in the situations. People came up with different things based on what their needs were and how they perceived it according to their lives. Right. So it was a lot of fun. Yeah. So there's no formula of how to apply this. It's very much about what happens when you leave here, when you go home, when you deal with the dog, when you, be grateful to all cats.
I have the cards, and I had a practice for a while where I would mix them up and have one per day that I would meditate on. But what I started last summer was, because of the retreat Muffy and I were on, that they had as some of the chanting in the morning, that all of the
they chant through all of the slogans,
which was wonderful. I kept that up, and because each day when I say them aloud, one will come out to me, and I'll go, "Wow, I didn't hear that before." And want to look it up, So it's very interesting how they keep on shifting and changing.
Yeah,
it is not uncommon to develop our own inner teenager with this material. That in my seminary, during the Mahayana program, during sitting, they would read the slogans. You just reminded me of that. And my attitude was like, go fuck off. I don't want to hear about this. And so there may be a part of you that responds there, and that's normal,
right?
Because we all have our inner defiant teenager, and that's a clue that we're being a little theistic about it.
Yeah, and I find you there's some you laugh at.
Yes.
There's some you just think are ridiculous.
Uh-huh.
In the same practice I was doing with Megan.
Yeah.
So I think the point is just dive in and don't make it your practice, make it your module, and also think about how you would like to contribute. Mm-hmm. And you can pair up with someone, you could make a skit, you could do something outrageous, and we'll try to prod and poke a little bit to see what we could, you know, get people to do. But really, it is an offering to the group if you're able to offer your interpretation or a way to help people feel energized by these slogans and this material. So it's not someone sitting there telling you that something, but I think it has to come. We have to internalize these or else it's pointless, really.
And I also want to stress, for those who are inclined, that there is an architecture to these slogans, so it is actually useful to look at them as a network.
Good.
So what are you doing next week?
Next week, I'm going to lead a meditation, a guided meditation. So
anything in particular?
You know, I don't know yet.
Okay.
I don't know. Great. So we're going to close with the dedication of merit. It's slightly different than you would know, but...